it's the ideal language of expression for me. And it takes time to get to understand that language and speak that language. But once you do, I just find it so rich. And at least for me personally, it goes far beyond anything that you can say with words.
That was Adam Jeppesen.
And this is Nordic Portraits. Adam Jeppesen is an art photographer and visual artist who first rose to international prominence with his groundbreaking 2008 series Wake, which resulted in a book of the same title being published by Steidl and subsequently nominated for a string of prestigious awards. Noted for his bold experimentation with form and materiality and exploring universal themes relating to the scientific, religious, and philosophical, Adam's work has been exhibited worldwide and is present in the permanent collections of the Denver Art Museum, the Danish Arts Foundation, and the Public National Arts Council in Sweden. Adam, welcome to Nordic Portraits.
Thank you so much.
Adam, I wondered if we could start by going back to early 2009, where you were about to embark on an epic journey, one that would see you spend 478 days in isolation as you traveled from the North to the South Pole with not much more than a camera on your shoulder. And I just wondered what it was that first led you to decide to step out into that adventure.
Well, so previous to that trip, to give a little background context, is that I came from a background of documentary filmmaking and having basically worked on documentary projects more as a cameraman, less than as the director. This was around the time when technology was changing rapidly from when you would go out and shoot. Typically, before this, you would be bringing larger cameras. And at around this time, there was a shift to a format called mini DV, which meant that cameras got a lot smaller. And by minimizing these cameras, it meant that you got access to certain situations that otherwise would have been difficult to. And kind of my thing was that I would go in and I would be able to do sound as well. So all of a sudden, a production team would become a lot smaller. So it would be just myself with a director. But at times it would also just be myself in order just to get the proper access. Today, that's quite common. But at that time, that was like a very new way of working. And so quite briefly thereafter, I started working on projects that centered around conflict zones, going in and documenting conflict zones, not in a newsworthy kind of a way, but more from the human perspective of what was happening inside these areas. And so I'd go in with my camera and I'd be filming, but I quite quickly realized that when I handed off the material to the director, it was sort of in their hands and I no longer had any control of how they would be editing it. So quickly thereafter, I started bringing always like a point and shoot camera in my pocket, more for myself to kind of keep the memory of these places that I would go into that, you know, would be very impactful environments I would be in. And because when you are filming, it's as if everything, your whole memory is just sucked into the camera. Afterwards, you have just this sort of odd, dreamy feeling of what you had experienced. And taking pictures for myself kind of became a way of freezing some of those moments so that I could remember it better. So I had been doing that for several years. And I would also typically go on a shoot or a production somewhere and I would ask if it was all right for me to stay a couple of weeks afterwards. And in that period after wrapping up, I would go out and just take my own pictures. And it didn't have any goal with that other than it was just for myself sort of to develop my visual language. But after a while, you know, I'd kind of built up a fairly, you know, large amount of work that was just in my drawer. And so I decided to take some time off and I rented this cabin up in Finland and I isolated myself there for 2 months with the aim of trying to edit this material into a book form. And that was sort of my first time that I kind of played around with my own work independent of anyone else and independent of it actually having a specific function. And like you said in the introduction, that resulted in this book, Wake. Now, Wake was very dependent that I could go on these trips, that I had this work that would allow me to go out to continue making this type of work. And at the same time, I saw that there was a huge shift in the type of productions that were being funded. You know, this was also around the time when reality TV really had its golden age. And I had a very hard time seeing myself working in that environment. And so I started looking more at how can I actually make my own work or fund my own work and put a greater emphasis on that. And I had been doing a couple of pictures while I'd been on a trip in South America where I'd been out shooting these landscapes in full moon. And I'd done these full moon landscapes. I would be isolated. And afterwards, I would go back and I would do research on what had happened on that exact same day, like which large events had been printed in the printed media all around the world. So I would look in news media from Africa, from Asia, from Europe, from North America, South America. And then I would take a handful of those, maybe 20 news stories that would all be printed in very like small print beneath this image that was blown up in a very large scale. And it kind of became this way of, are you reacting to the work on an intellectual level of actually reading these factual things that are happening, or are you seeing it more from an emotional standpoint of this vast landscape of isolation? That work, I presented it to the National Museum of Photography here in Copenhagen, and they were interested in doing an exhibition with that. And so they asked me if I could present around 15 images for an upcoming show. And I quickly calculated that in order to do 15 images, I'd need maybe around 15 months because I'm shooting only around full moon and given one day before, one day after maybe, but effectively I would need around 12 to 15 months to do this work. And so it got me to thinking that I grew up in New York from around 7 till I was 14. And at that time, I'd always been fascinated by this idea that the North and the South American continent was connected. This idea that you could actually drive from Alaska all the way down to the tip of South America without actually having to fly. Like as a kid, I was always dreaming about this trip. Again, I wasn't looking at it, you know, crossing borders. I wasn't looking at it in the political sense. It was more like the real physical, like I can walk out my door and I could go all the way to the tip of South America. And so I began thinking, that might actually be a good excuse for doing these, you know, 15 months of travel. But then when I began doing fundraising for it, I realized that it's kind of, you know, top of Alaska down to the tip of South America isn't as clear. And so instead, I kind of turned my applications into I'll travel from the North Pole to the South Pole, A to B, easy to understand. And I ended up actually getting funding for that. And so I set off on this trip. I didn't have a final time of when I needed to be back. I estimated it would probably be around a year and a half to 2 years. It would all be land-based. And a big challenge was, how do I get to the North Pole? And eventually I was able to get a trip on an icebreaker that was doing research in the Arctic. And once we reached the North Pole, I kind of clicked the stopwatch. And that's when my trip officially began. And as you said, then 487 days later, I reached Antarctica. I never made it to the actual South Pole station. I got as far as I possibly could. And I like said, all right, this is it. And yeah, that's how that trip went.
And just on a purely practical level, what sort of challenges did you meet along the way in trying to navigate such an ambitious route?
Well, I mean, you know, previous to actually just leaving my house, I mean, there's also just the practicality of how do you get the funding for doing a trip like this? What do you do with your stuff here? I'm going away for 2 years. I'm not going to have my studio sitting. So lots of that came down to not wanting to have any distractions and feeling like I had something pulling me back. And so I got rid of everything I basically had before leaving for this trip. And once on the trip, it was actually, I mean, I guess you can call it practical, but it was a lot more psychological. So as you would know from any trip that you plan, the reality is so different from once you actually get there. Whatever your intention was on going someplace, my experience had been, I had had this like romantic idea of, apart from the Arctic, once I get to Canada, I would be buying this camper van. And I had this whole story spun in my mind of I was going to buy this. It's like an old VW 4x4 called a Synchro. And it would be all rigged out. And, you know, I'd have the kitchen and I'd have my studio in there. And I'd drive this thing to the tip of South America. Again, like a 7-year-old. And psychologically, I just realized, because I did that, I actually found this mint condition Synchro sitting in Nova Scotia. And I poured in all my funding into this vehicle. And then I set out and I crossed Canada. But it came with the price of, first of all, the constant worry. If anything happens to this vehicle, I'm screwed. Like, I literally cannot move on. Like, my whole budget is in these four wheels. So that in of itself kind of put a lot of stress on it. And then the second thing was, it was so incredibly comfortable just sitting in there. I was crossing Canada in like the fall and early winter, and just sitting and driving and listening to music and seeing the landscapes go by. At a certain point, I'm like, I should be working. You know, like I also have like an obligation. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't because I was supposed to be working and actually making an exhibition. And so when I reached the west coast of Canada, I was like, this isn't cutting it. I got to change my method. And at that point, I sold off the van and I downgraded to a bicycle. And that actually put a lot more, it forced me into taking my work more serious in a certain way, which again, kind of became an excuse because it was just at times so unbearable to continue biking. And it was much easier just to get out my camera and set it up and actually spend, you know, like a fair amount of time shooting and, you know, engaging with the landscape in a different way. And plus, having said that, on a more serious level, living in the elements does something very different. It definitely engages you a lot more. And so my project had been described as a work that was documenting the geographical subtle changes between the continents. Let's say it was very much in a theoretical way, the way the project had originally been described. But afterwards, it became a lot more about my experience spending long periods of time by myself. So it actually became more of a study on solitude and on how when your only companion is your camera and you're witnessing the same thing together, what does that look like? You know, what's the result of that? And so the work became, it actually, I never ended, I didn't do that exhibition because in total, I didn't get to shoot many pictures that actually fit into that idea of what I had proposed in the beginning. And instead, the work became, I would call it perhaps more of an honest expression of what it's actually like to spend vast amounts of time in nature with yourself. So not in this romanticizing idea of what nature is, but actually also looking at nature from its like ugly side and its rough side, and also looking at the medium of photography in that type of an environment. You know, photography typically has a tradition of being a very controlled medium, you know, lots of it due to its technical nature and also just its technical background of it being, you know, you got to do it in this perfect way. And I've sort of been trained in that way, unconsciously at least. You know, for me, producing a print was always about the print needs to be exquisite. It needs to be the right paper. It can't have any dust on there. And when you are living in a tent and you're shooting what's called large format, which is basically sheets of film that you load into these cassettes, after a while, you know, dust and grit gets into these cassettes. And the result of that is when you're pulling out the film to change them, because one cassette can only hold two pieces of film, they would get scratched and they would get dust. And I didn't realize that during my travels, but when I came back and began, you know, reviewing my material, that became evident. And, you know, my initial thought was like, I've ruined it. All this material is useless. And then I just realized that that's actually what that experience was like. If I start editing out the scratches and the dust, all of a sudden, I'm trying to polish it up to something it wasn't like. So if I'm actually speaking about what is this experience like, you got to include all of those imperfections. And so that was a huge shift in my visual language and how I appreciate visual art.
You talk about the evolution of the project throughout that journey. I'm curious, just on a very personal level, what does that do to someone to be in solitude for such a long period of time?
You go through different phases. I mean, I think anyone who has tried it will recognize that it's not a stable experience. It doesn't start and end in a way that you can foresee, but it typically goes through these phases. And usually the first 2 weeks can be quite tough. I mean, really tough, and only getting worse and worse and worse as each day goes on. And, you know, a lot of self-doubt. What am I doing here? Nothing's ever going to come of this. And, you know, just all your demons start coming up. And then typically there's a shift around 2 weeks, like a very dramatic shift that will happen, kind of like that the clouds just, they disappear. And all of a sudden you begin relaxing into the moment a lot more. And there's a much greater acceptance of this circumstance. And that can last for quite a long time. having said that, of course, there are times when the clouds, they drift over again. And I've never done longer than 2 months in solitude in the same place. So I can't speak of that. But I did realize on this trip that if I was to do something similar to what I did on this trip, I would probably like to see what is it like to stay in one place. Because when you're moving, there is a lot of distraction in that as well. Also a lot of distraction from your own emotions and from your own perception. Because you're just trying to decipher the landscape you're moving through and the challenges that are posed by very basic things like, what do you do about food? What do you do about water? You know, you can be in the desert and, you know, there's a lot of worry that goes into like, all right, I really need to get something to drink now. Whereas if you are set up in some place where you have the basics covered, I think you can probably go a lot deeper. And I'd like to experience that.
Are you able to draw on that even now when you're in an environment surrounded by distraction? Is that something that has helped you be able to get in touch with your inner self more easily?
I think so. I think definitely, but I do think you need to be constantly reminded of it. It always surprises me how perception works and optical illusions work and how you can actually see, you can actually be explained that this is how the optical illusion, they can even show it to you. And then they show you the illusion without saying like, this is what's happening. And still your brain is tricked into like seeing the illusion and not seeing the reality. And the same thing goes for when you have had this sort of experience, you've had some sort of an insight into your own psychology. It's not enough just for you to know that that is a possibility. You do also need to put yourself into the situation where that happens. And so for me, for many years following that trip, I went from working a lot in the field to working a lot in the studio. And, you know, my main practice today also is done in a studio. But I'm seeing more so than ever today, especially with the rise of how artificial intelligence is coming into my work, that there's going to be a greater need for me to be reminded by actually going into nature, whether it's doing work or whether the work becomes the excuse for going into nature. I'll have to see, but that's something that I'm starting to realize more now.
You mentioned that at a young age, you and your family moved to New York, to Westchester, and you stayed there in your formative years up until the age of 14 when you returned to Denmark. Have you reflected, Adam, on what impact that's had on your sense of self and sense of home and how that's influenced you in your work?
You know, I mean, if you've had that experience, it's hard to know how life would look like without having had that. So I can't see how that has influenced me, but it becomes quite evident when I see others that have not had that experience that are absolutely comfortable staying in one place. Like I have been rootless, but I feel I've been that way my whole life. And that's probably just because when we moved there, you know, it's around the time when my memories began to be formed properly. And so for me, it's always been natural to move around. I've never felt like I belong in one place. And part of it perhaps is due just to the fact that we moved. Another part, I think, is also just personality. Because it's not just around place. It's also about belonging in a certain group as well. You know, do I belong in the art environment? I don't really feel that either. So I've always felt a little bit like, I wouldn't say an outsider, but I've prioritized going my own ways.
So when you returned to Denmark, you then finished your studies and you mentioned your first magical experience of entering a dark room at 18. Can you just describe what happened to you when you first encountered photography in that way?
Well, so my uncle, my mom's brother had a dark room and he was a teacher, but when he wasn't at school, he spent his time in his dark room. And so whenever we'd go visit, I saw his dark room, but he was a tough guy and I think I peeked into the dark room, but it didn't really intrigue me that much. I did see his pictures and I saw his enthusiasm around photography. And I realized that my grandfather had also been taking pictures and perhaps it influenced him. And in our time in New York, at some point, my mom began playing around with photography and actually went to do some classes outside of our home. And she would come back with these pictures. So it had always been in the periphery around me. And then around the age of 18, I was in high school here and I really had no idea what I was going to be doing after school. And a friend of mine took me to this like night school of photography. And that was the first time I saw that moment of just that space. I mean, perhaps sacred is too large of a word, but it certainly felt that way at the time. Being in this room with this red light, there's a certain quietness. You can hear the water trickling and like just there's a lot of sensorial elements to the dark room. And then on top of that, you have this thing of where you're exposing this image that comes out onto this paper. And again, like the sound of the clicking of when the light comes on and the clock that is ticking, like there are all of these tiny elements and it's still this white paper. And then you put it into this liquid under this red light. And all of a sudden you just see this image start emerging. I mean, that gave me goosebumps at that time. I was like, it was like alchemy. And from that moment on, I was hooked. I was hooked on getting back into the dark room, on going out and capturing something and bringing it in there. I don't know which I placed more emphasis on because it was important, the picture that I took, so that when I processed it in the dark room, it would be something that was worth processing. And I mean, not long after that, unfortunately, the dark room started phasing out. And I never became like a nerd around. It needs to be, I was completely happy with just the basic dark room of like some plastic paper and seeing the image emerge.
So obviously you might not necessarily be spending much time in a dark room, but you've never moved across entirely to digital.
No. So not long after I began photographing, I actually came across a large, someone was throwing out a bunch of large format films that had expired. And I quickly just calculated, like, there's films here for a lot of money. It would actually be cheaper for me to go out and buy a large format camera and just use this old stock than to continue buying new film for my small camera. And so I began shooting large format due to a very like practical reason, but quickly realized that large format photography is a very meditative experience because everything needs to be measured out. You don't have a camera. You're not looking through a viewfinder. You're not pointing and shooting. And typically, you know, you have to be a little more careful around these films because they are a lot more expensive. You care a little bit more for the way you set up your camera, you know, for how you frame your image and for the lighting, and everything needs to be measured out also by hand. So it puts you in touch with wherever you are, whatever it is that you're photographing. And I quickly came to appreciate that. So I've kind of kept shooting on that format. I'm sure now there's probably digital cameras that surpass quality, but you will never be able to reproduce the feeling of photographing when you shoot analog. I would probably say analog today, any sort of analog, because in general, analog, you're more in touch with what you're shooting than if you're shooting digital, because digital is just, there's no limit to the amount of pictures. But yeah, if I do go out, I will still be bringing a large format camera. Having said that, I mean, of course, I carry an iPhone camera for documenting life, but I've never used it for anything other than that.
And you describe it as almost this meditative state. I know, particularly with the full moon long exposure shots, we're talking up to 20, 25 minutes.
Yeah, I believe it would be, I mean, depending on how much moonlight there would be, or longer even. And of course, that in of itself gives you some results that are out of your control. And so part of this thing, as I mentioned on this trip, of kind of embracing these imperfections, there's also part of like leaving, I began realizing that leaving a lot up to chance became far more interesting than me trying to control the environment and control the expression that I wanted. For example, like long time exposures, they give movements in trees or, you know, there's just different things happening that you can't control. And once you see the image, it's always like it's not always a pleasant surprise, but it's always a surprise. And I think that keeps me on my toes.
This idea of embracing the imperfection, the Japanese term wabi-sabi, can you speak a little to the philosophy behind it and how much that has played into your own practice?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't aware of wabi-sabi for years while still practicing this type of embracing the imperfection in my work. And so the day when I came across this book written by an author called Leonard Cohen, and he's kind of written this beautiful little Bible which tries to explain the unexplainable and what is wabi-sabi. But very briefly, I mean, it's a philosophy that stems from Japan, which it's made up of several elements, and the sum of those elements still doesn't really explain the overall feel of it because it is such an emotional way of engaging. But you could probably boil it down to that it's about embracing imperfection and embracing the constant change in all matter. So instead of viewing something as frozen in its moment, that it's still in a process of change, whether that might be subtle or it could be a faster process of change. And I started, once I had read this, I began recognizing lots of these elements in my own work, and it became a lot easier for me to actually know where to place my emphasis. And I also sort of felt that it had validated what I had been doing, because I hadn't really seen this, especially in photography, of like the imperfect image. And all of a sudden I was like, there is actually a place for this. There's actually a term and a language and a community that understands this. And so that has helped me inform the work I do today, whether that be photography or it be working with sculpture or other materials as well. It constantly serves as a guide for my work. And now as I've been working the last several years more with technology and also with artificial intelligence and looking at very technological based things, how does a wabi-sabi mindset fit into that? It's a challenge that I'm trying to kind of come to terms with and find out if there is a place and how that place would possibly look. I believe that there is a place for it, but I'm still trying to find the form for that.
You mentioned with the Flatlands Camp project that essentially the outcome of that project was vastly different to what you'd intended going into it. And that seems to be a common thread throughout your career. I just wondered what sort of a role editing plays in all of this and what you've learned through that. I know that was a big moment for you going to Finland and also, again, experiencing isolation and sitting with your own work in the aftermath. Can you speak a little to how you've learned to edit over the years?
I mean, in general, I think I'm perhaps a better editor than I am a photographer. Like if someone hired me to do an image, it would be an absolute nightmare because I have an idea in my mind, but actually like having enough self-control to just following that idea and not following my intuition in the moment, which I think if you are to be good at doing that type of work, you need to just stick to your idea. And I'm not very good at that. And so typically my ideas evolve throughout the whole process. And often that results in like something comes out very different from what I imagined. And I have to every time, I mean, I've used this in the past a lot where I would go out, shoot something, and then I would not look at it for 6 months or even a year. It would need to come to the point of when I could actually forget my intention with it to actually look at it from just, is this good or is it not good work? Because I would find that my ideas and my intentions, it would always be a disappointment because I'd be like, this looks nothing like what I was intending. And I would often feel down by that and be like, I can't use this. But then when time passed, all of a sudden you start seeing it through the eyes of the broader audience. They don't know your intentions. And it becomes about, is this good work or is it not good work? And that all comes down to editing. Today, that plays as vital a role. The thing is, if you look at how images are being produced and viewed today, it is moving at such a high pace that actually allowing yourself that time, that break away from it, really requires a lot of discipline. At times, I can struggle with that, but yeah, that's still my intention. I still think that, you know, let's look at these large language models that are producing images, and you're able to produce at a speed unlike anything in the past. Now, if you take that, and I could see, because I'd worked on these models for a year now, and initially I saw some images and I was like, oh, they're ready to go. Like, I'm ready to print this. This is going to blow people backwards. This technology is wild. And now I've started seeing slowly those exhibitions are starting to pop up in those images. And I can only say I'm happy that I didn't, you know, follow through on that at that time, because that type of work really requires, all right, let's just breathe for a second. It's very impactful. It's very impressive. But you need to see, how does this age? at least give it a year and just see how does this look in a year from now. Yeah, so I'm trying to still sit on that work and see where that goes.
So in order to not act impulsively and release or exhibit works immediately and give them the time to breathe, is there anyone else that you're speaking to during this process? Do you have any close confidants that you would dialogue with, or is it very much your own intuition that you're relying on?
I rely mainly on my own intuition. Of course, I spend a lot of time, you know, I show a lot of the work to my wife and we discuss a lot of it. But I also find that no matter who I actually show my work to, ultimately, I have a hard time putting words on the intention or the feeling of my work. And so I might be able to have an intellectual conversation as this work is not working. And we might also be able to speak about the aesthetics of it. That can help me realize if I'm getting closer or further away from my idea. But ultimately, it comes down to this feeling that actually can take 2 seconds if it's at the right time. It was somehow easier when I was working more traditionally with photography, when it was like, you could look at this, is it a good picture, is it not a good picture, what size should it have? Now, my work has become more object-based. So there are more elements added on top of it. And the adding of these elements is a lot more difficult to take that time I was talking about before. Because at which point are you taking that time to actually put it away and then take it out again? Is that from when you have placed the last layer on top of your image? Or is it from the start of that image, discussing what could be done to this image in order to make it more transcendent?
How is it for you then when, as an artist, you release a work and it's out of your hands and the public can project their own meaning onto it, often varying from what you might have intended yourself? How is that for you?
I have no problem with that. I mean, I think that is part of the beauty as well. And I often take it as, you know, at times it can be quite entertaining. There can be lots of things read into your work that wasn't my intention, or at least my conscious intention. I mean, it can even get to the point when it's like, wow, they might be right. Like, I might actually, that might have been my idea, but it's so deep in my consciousness that I hadn't defined it in that sort of a way. I mean, I generally have a hard time putting the words to my own work. I can speak of the surface of it and I can speak of the creation of it, but the more powerful thing that hopefully speaks to you, I have a hard time, you know, I feel it more in my belly and in my heart. And so when you kind of release it and people look at it and have their opinions and they read their things into it, I think it's always interesting to see how does that speak to them. Now, majority of all my work has been very subjective. It's been my subjective experience into how I move throughout the world. And lately, my work has had, I mean, not that there's a final that it needs to result in something, but my work around artificial intelligence, and I've done a lot of work around existential risk, those are themes that have a very clear aim. And I think if people read the wrong thing into that, it's more as if they might actually be losing the overall intention, which in general, I think is extremely relevant today. And so I would wish for people to engage in conversation around what my idea is behind that work.
Yeah, well, an interesting example of that and you stepping more into object-based art was The Great Filter, your 2019 exhibition at Brandt Museum. And it was this phenomenal large-scale exhibition, one of the main pieces being this 60-by-9-meter constellation of 2,500 objects that were made of sand and concrete, and then also these amazing towers that almost look as if they're teetering on the brink. And I just wondered what informed those works philosophically and how it was for you to step out into something that was far more sculptural based.
So I'd been working on photographic work that had been sculptural in a certain way. And so it felt natural for me to perhaps embrace the sculpture and leave the photography behind. It wasn't necessary for me to have the photography as a companion throughout all my work. And I began working on that work in Argentina, where at that time I was living. And part of living far away from where my work is usually shown also means that I have a kind of a neutral way of, I'm not being influenced very much by what else I'm seeing being made. And so it gives me a pure way of engaging with my own work. And so I began experimenting with these towers and this way of working with these molds that was actually just these molds of sandcastles and working around repetition. Now, my photography had also dealt with repetition and the repetition of the image and what that did to it. I'd done a series where the image would start fading by simply just repeating the printing of the same image. And I thought, can you translate that into a physical object? And so I began making these copies of this mold over and over and over again. And then they would slowly, because it was sand, start collapsing in different ways. And there was just a very beautiful poetic aesthetic to that that spoke to me. And around that time, I had begun reading work on existential risk. You know, this all culminates with the election of Donald Trump in the US and seeing how quickly a society can fracture. And not just in the US, but also in Europe around that time, you know, the rise of nationalists and how fragile the world is and how fragile democracy is. And so I felt it became relevant for me to take a break from my own subjective work of being out in the field and doing my own studies on solitude and perhaps engage a little bit about these, you know, quite serious themes or tendencies that I was seeing in the world. And so reading work on existential risk, and especially I later read a book by, I think he's an Australian author and philosopher, Toby Orr, called The Precipice. And in the end of this book, he calls to arms anyone who works within any field to do whatever you can to try to bring awareness to these very serious topics. So I thought, you know, as an artist, I need to make work that at least can start a conversation, because I wasn't seeing a lot of that in general in the art world. So I began working with this idea. There's a concept called the great filter, which is basically trying to answer the question of why is it that we haven't found any signs of life in the universe? You know, why when we look out there is just silent? And so the idea is that perhaps when a society gets to a certain technological level, it kind of becomes self-destructive and it becomes difficult for any advancing society to pass through this filter without imploding. So the question was, are we with the rapid advancements, both within AI, within biotech, even, you know, just within the last 100 years of nuclear, are we perhaps moving into this filter? If such a filter does exist, are we going to emerge on the other side of it? And so the work at Brandt's was kind of a way of questioning, does that filter exist? What could our world look like afterwards? All of a sudden, these naive sandcastles became this, it had an apocalyptic tone to it, where it kind of felt like this large city that was crumbling in a certain way. And the same goes with the towers that you mentioned. But it was set in a very somber, sober setting where there was a couple of benches set up, and it also became a space for meditation and a very silent room for just sitting. And the room of where this exhibition took place had a beautiful light and was very influenced by the natural light outside. So you wouldn't necessarily need to go down the dark road. There is also a lighter path that could be taken. So yeah, that work is still informing the work I do today, which today I've taken one of these existential risks and tried to understand that better. And that's artificial intelligence.
Can you share a little more about what you've been working with recently within the area of artificial intelligence?
Sure. I mean, in the beginning, so this is before like any of these large language models came out. I was impressed by how especially the human face and the human image was being created using AI. And it didn't take a lot of thought to realize how much potential there is in how that can be manipulated and used in ways that, I mean, you could question, why would we even need to have images of humans that don't exist? And so I kind of looked at that, and I would sit with these models or with these algorithms that were reproducing images of humans and kind of going back to this idea of the optical illusion, despite me knowing that this person doesn't exist and is nothing but numbers, I would still emotionally engage with these images. Like my first initial human feel would be like, oh, that's a cute kid sitting there by the beach. Or that man looks angry. Oh, I'm sure that woman has had a tough day. Like all of these things that I'm just reading into these images that just isn't there. And I was kind of surprised by myself in that. And so right around the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, I kind of got caught away from where I was living with my family at that time. We were in Argentina and we couldn't return back to Argentina because we'd been out of the country when they closed the border. And instead, we ended up going to Uruguay. And that was, you know, at that time thinking this pandemic will pass in a couple of weeks and we'll go home again. After, you know, several months, I was like, oh, this looks more permanent. I'm going to need to find a way of actually creating work here in Uruguay, but I didn't have any materials. The only thing I had was I had been doing this work with these algorithms and I had these kind of flat images that I didn't really see a lot of use for because anyone could go and look at these images on these algorithms and have sort of the same feeling as I had, but it didn't really, it still felt there was a separation between the technology and call it the biology of ourselves. And so I wanted to find a way that I could build a bridge between those things because I firmly believe that the way we engage with technology today is not separate from us. And despite us wanting to have that, it and us, today on many levels, it is part of who we are. It might not be like chips that are embedded in our brains, but we are certainly having the whole psychology of it hacking our brains. And so I wanted to make a project that built that bridge. And I came across some guy who was also stuck in the pandemic in London who had begun working with this very old photographic method called anthotypes, where you basically take plants and you derive the pigments from the plants or the flowers. And by applying that pigment onto paper, you can place a negative or whatever on top, place it in the sun, and the image gets transferred to the paper by the method of the sun bleaching the paper where there is no negative, if that makes sense.
Yep.
And when you remove the negative, you have this image onto the paper. So it's a very interesting method also because it's not light fast. Again, it plays into lots of these elements of what wabi-sabi is. First of all, imperfection, but also that there's a constant change in the materials. So it really spoke to me. And I thought, was there a way of perhaps merging these super ultra tech technological images with the most basic form of image reproducing? And so I began basically collecting large quantities of eucalyptus and boiling it down and extracting that pigment that's in eucalyptus, and then boiling paper, transferring the pigments onto the paper. And then I would print out these faces of these people that don't exist, and I'd place it on top of this paper. And due to the fact that anthotype is such a slow process, they would need to stay outside from anywhere between 3 weeks to several months. And in that period of time, the results are so influenced by the weather, by the time of year, by how the sun moves across the sky, that the images ended up becoming these sort of blurry, ghostly images. So they took them away from being these very concrete faces. And somehow by doing that, they became a lot more how we internally see other humans or how we internally recall memory of others. And somehow they became a lot more powerful and a lot more relevant. It wasn't like the awe of, this person doesn't exist. It was also the first emotion would be like, this reminds me of my grandfather, or I think I've seen this person, I would hear people say. And so I've just, due to the slow nature of this process, I continue working on building this body of work of these images that, again, are very simple portraits of people that don't exist.
You mentioned memory and recollection, and that seems to be an ongoing theme through a lot of your work. How was it then for you in the lead up to the release of your book, Error Object Structure, which was a retrospective? How was it for you to go back through your own work, seeing your journey as an artist and also as a person? Did that illuminate anything for you?
No, that was terrifying. No, I mean, honestly, like I looked at that book and I felt there was something fundamental missing. And to this day, I still can't place my finger on what that is. It's as if, I can only say that there's something that is missing to tie that together. I mean, that book was a challenge because it took its starting point in these landscapes, and it ended up with that exhibition at Brandt. So it moved from this very subjective way of viewing the world to this relevant work around existential risk. And those were two worlds that were difficult to merge. Having said that, it's always interesting to see it at a distance and actually look at your work, you know, over longer time and being like, wow, that was, you know, I was onto something there. And again, my wife has always said, like, you need to stick longer with what you're doing, because I have a tendency to work on something for a few years and then move on to something else. You know, I'm a firm believer that to maintain a healthy mind and to train your mind, it's good that once you reach kind of just the routine of something, to switch it up a little bit. And for that reason, I often switch up my medium, or I switch up my materials to challenge myself. But I've been looking at that book and I've been seeing, like, oh, I could definitely do more of that. I would like to see what happened if I had stuck with that longer. Now, there's no reason for me not to go back and pick something up again. Actually, recently, that book has become almost something that I would go and look at and be like, ah, if I do return to working more in nature, I want to go back and start doing this type of work again and seeing what happens with new eyes.
And in the spirit of Wabi Sabi and this idea that things are constantly growing and evolving, do you reflect on older projects and see new things when you return to them?
No, not very much. I typically don't go back and look at the older works. I spend majority of time just trying to navigate the present moment and finding out where this is going and seeing where, you know, my work often guides me. So it's less of me being the overall director of it, and it's more me having to kind of, I'm just one step behind and trying to follow where the work is taking me. The last year, and that will continue into the next couple of years, hopefully, I'm starting to work a lot more in collaborative work, which is really interesting as well, because there's a lot more like ping ponging going on. And again, you got to stay on your toes to be sure that this is taking you in a direction that you can kind of sign off for.
Yeah, I'm curious about that, because you have mentioned in the past that it's become a recent thing for you to embrace collaboration. What are your initial takeouts from having worked with others now in terms of what makes for a positive collaboration?
Well, I almost would say that any collaboration, I think, would be a positive, even though it might be a somewhat painful collaboration. I still think that as an artist or working in any kind of a creative field is just a very, like I said, it's an important challenge to pose yourself. Someone who might have radically different opinions or views or ways of seeing the world, how can you two mix and take it as something that almost like you have to mix something together? Like, you might not want to mix red and blue, but if you do, something's going to come out of it. And whatever comes out of it, just of actually physically doing something together, I think is positive. I mean, and that can come down to collaborative work, but it can also just come down to yourself. So often, you know, if someone has a hard time getting anything done, I will just say, it doesn't matter what you get done. Just the actual act of doing is important. And it's as if the benefits of that somehow get dialed up when it's collaborative work. I would even like to see what would happen if I begin working with someone who, let's say, works with music. Like, where does that take you? Or any other medium that's kind of foreign to myself. Up until now, the collaborative work has forced me into working in very concretely in materials that I'm not very comfortable with. So right now I'm working with someone who has a high knowledge of wood. And for me, wood is an extremely difficult material to work in because it's so fixed and it's very difficult to kind of break this structure that wood has. Whereas if you work, let's say, with sand or earth or mud, these are type of materials that have their own kind of movements that you can't control. Wood is such an, quote unquote, like an easy material to control. And it's very difficult to get an expression that shows you losing that control. Now, collaborating in this sort of way, all of a sudden is like, ah, that's interesting. How are we going to try to break that if that's what we want? Like, what can you show me with your knowledge of where this material can take us?
And could you see yourself working with material where there isn't an element of surprise? It seems that you thrive on that aspect of the unexpected.
I mean, Listen, like I said, I'm not very good at any materials. So I think there will always be a knack. Like if I'm at the controls, it will be an element of surprise no matter what. And I think even with medium, let's say we take video, for example, that I've also worked with, that is definitely more controlled. I enjoy going down the paths where it's like, oh, you're not supposed to do that. It's not meant for that. You're not supposed to crank up that filter so much because it breaks the image. If I hear that, then it's like, oh, we should try that and see how that works. So I almost think that in any material, there is that. Having said that, I can definitely romanticize this idea of one day sitting down and just making something that's very, you know, take like David Lynch in The Straight Story, something where he just takes something and, you know, do it well, do it correct. I think there is also an appeal in that.
What fuels your creativity on a regular basis?
I think right in this moment right now, as I said, like I think with the emergence of these new technologies, I think it's extremely important to be aware of how that influences you. Is it healthy? You kind of have to approach it in a research sort of way and not let it overtake you. And so I've become a lot more aware of simple things like taking long walks, bringing yourself into a space where your physical self comes back to you and not get caught up so much in your own mind. And for me, at least, nature is just, you know, the best instrument for that.
And in terms of spirituality, where do you find yourself today?
That's a good question. I mean, I see myself hopefully being able to engage more in like a spiritual life, hopefully finding time for more meditation and more personal insight into the work. Into the work, but also into, you know, privately into my own life and into understanding the mind better. So I see spirituality in that sense and as something that I think is it's an ongoing process, of course. But I don't find that I have a very clear, at least something that I'm able to express in words of how I see my own spirituality.
Do you find that the work plays a role in that?
Of course. Very much so. I mean, I think the work is probably the clearest expression of where I am in this moment. Like, I think my work is fundamental in that expression. And I also think it's far more relevant than my way of being able to express it in other forms. So if I'm able to create work that I can sit with, and get knowledge from it and even be able perhaps to pass that on to others. I mean, I think that's like, I couldn't dream of anything better than that.
Final question, particularly with your recent work, you've dealt with questions of existential threat. How do you feel about the role of technology in society and the future that your children will inherit?
Well, obviously that's a huge worry. I think it's important, of course, to stay optimistic. And that recently came because I read a book with someone who was absolutely pessimistic. Because up until that, I'd kind of thought, well, let's also be honest. Like, we're not going in a good direction. And we can all constantly be saying, you know, there's still time to change the environmental impact, but we're just not seeing these changes. But then again, I do think having an optimistic view that we still have a possibility is fundamental, because if not, that's just giving up. And then we know where that's going to lead to. Whereas however improbable it might be, if you are optimistic, you still have a chance to change certain things. But everything that I work with today are themes that I honestly have a great worry about. I mean, the headless advancement in technology solely for the purpose of advancement and growth, you know, these themes that run throughout our society with something that is so potentially powerful, I can't see how others cannot have at least a worry about where that might take us. And like I said, right now, I'm looking at artificial intelligence because that's just one of the themes you can kind of look at, but there are plenty of others that as well are worrying. And I think most importantly at this point is just engaging in making awareness of it. Many of these technologies go under the radar for the majority of society, and you're not really, you know, we're not noticing the implementation. We're talking very few people who are actually in control of this. And these are technologies that can radically change both how we are as humans and also just the general world that we inhabit.
Hmm. It's fascinating to hear how your art is very much a method of processing these big ideas. Have you ever thought about what you'd be like as a person who didn't have art as a way of expressing yourself?
No, I've never thought of that. And I don't think I want to think about that. Because, I mean, honestly, like, it's the ideal language of expression for me. And it takes time to get to understand that language and speak that language. But once you do, I just find it so rich. And at least for me personally, it goes far beyond anything that you can say with words. But of course, it requires a consistency across culture. And that is something that's very difficult to gain with art. And I realize, of course, that my art only speaks to a certain, let's call it mindset, that is also in line with where I'm going. And so I do realize that there's lots of limits to it. But for me personally, for what I want to say, there's no other or better way of expressing it than through art.
I think that's as good a point to end on as any. Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to share your personal story and reflections on your work with us today.
Thank you. Pleasure being here.
Nordic Portraits is a series by me, Ben Catford. The music was composed by Nina Liu and the visual identity by Copenhagen-based studio Frame. To learn more about today's guest and all the others from this season, visit nordicportraits.net. You can also follow us on Instagram and remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes so we can get the word out. Thanks for listening.